All right, I'm very happy to have today Dweezil Zappa as a guest. Dweezil, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
I'm very happy to have you available. We talked a little bit off the air, Dweezil, about some of the issues I want to talk about. Primarily, of course, I know what you're doing. We're going to talk about Zappa, Plays Zappa, which I've seen two or three times live. We're going to talk about what you're doing, I guess, in an archival sense for the music that that Frank wrote and produced and all that great stuff. And I also, as we mentioned, this will primarily play on a jazz program. And I've always felt this connection with the Zappa music, which I've always been a fan of, if you know my age. But as I said, if nothing else, if I hadn't even heard the music, which I have, if I look at an album, Weasels Rip My Flesh, and I see a tune on there entitled The Eric Dolphy Memorial Barbecue, you pretty much got me at that point as far as what Frank is doing. So just so you know where I'm coming from, I'm a big Eric Dolphy fan, and if I see someone that's writing a tune in that style that Frank has, obviously he's got some connection with jazz influencing his music.
Yeah, he certainly did, but one of the things that was pretty clear in his whole career was that music to him was the greatest art form, and he just loved everything about it. But he also didn't like when things were being taken too seriously, or some sort of traditions sort of didn't allow for any kind of movement to go away from the standard thing. So he had a quote: without deviation from the norm, progress is not possible. So that said, he wasn't the kind of jazz snob that can exist in the world where it can only be one thing and otherwise it's not good. So he liked to mix a lot of different things in his music: classical, jazz, rock, funk, everything, sometimes all in one song. So that's one of the unique things about his music.
Well, and I we can talk about jazz chords and jazz patterns and whatnot, and I don't mean to imply that even a tune that's named with Eric Dolphy, I don't want to imply that they're going to hear those type of runs and whatnot, but certainly the avenue there for expression and creative within the context of a tune. When Frank wrote a tune, it was very tight, and the timing was very tight, and I want to talk about that also. But certainly the ability to express yourself, which is really that essence of the creativity that I include in that all-encompassing word of jazz, which is just too big to talk about. But the creativity and, as you're saying, not being bound by a particular form.
Yeah, I mean, that's the ultimate goal in a creative pursuit anyway, is to have freedom to express your ideas in totality. I mean, one of the distinctions that can be made, though, is that the process of recording is different than the process of performing live. And the best records, the best examples of music that really reaches people is often from a live performance, because it's something that is this sort of universal language. You can, when you hear other people that are connected in this one idea that's in front of them and moving forward in sort of a living, breathing thing, especially in improvisational forms such as jazz music and stuff like that, you get a sense of the all the effort and the work that has gone into that particular performer's their whole abilities are right out there in an improvisational way. So that's sometimes really hard to capture what is going on, but my dad, in all of the over 80 albums that he made, mostly recorded live performances of things. That is another element to what I think makes my dad's music interesting, but also you know, jazz music in general, is it tends to be more of a live thing because you want to have that interplay, the interaction between the musicians to create what the music is. And it's very different than when you're doing something that is, for lack of a better term, more commercial.
Right.
That's to be, you know, very specifically targeting one audience, but a mass audience that's sort of lowest common denominator. So that tends to make things, in a lot of cases, a lot less interesting.
Well, and you're right. And the thing, too, is to point out is by the time that a band takes this, that musicians take the stand, the stage with you, or when they took the stage with Frank, they've pretty much mastered the instrument or the instruments, because you have many people that play with Zappa, plays Zappa, mm-hmm. now there are multiple instruments. They've mastered that. So they are free to create, you know, off of something that you do, or you do something off of what they play, because you know where you're going to go and you can find it all. In other words, you don't hire people, and I got the feeling that Frank didn't hire people that just read charts. I mean, you have to, but I got the feeling he didn't hire people that just read charts, that they had to master it. They knew the music, the timing, which is so unbelievably complicated. I can't imagine pulling off the timing of some of the stuff that he wrote and getting. I mean, it's like trying to get on stage with Thelonious Monk and trying to keep every little thing when you're into that bebop mode, and all of a sudden Monk came along and just kind of blew everything apart, the stops and starts. But by the time you take the stage with Zappa, plays Zappa, everyone you have is a master of what they're doing, and then they have the ability, based on that, to create. And that really is that improvisational aspect of the music.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of, unfortunately, a bit of a lost art, because in the world of quote-unquote popular music, that's not a skill that's required of most people. So, you know, it's a great thing to be able to have the outlet as a musician to play structured parts and then have total freedom in the improvisational area. That's designed inherently in Frank's music. You know, he would have the theme or the head of the song, and then there would be wide open improvisational part, and then you come back to the song in the most simplistic form. You know, there's a lot of songs that have a very different kind of structure than that, but you know, most of the things on average have this kind of approach. So you do have the structure of having to play the strictly composed parts, and then, you know, that other amount of freedom for improvisation. So the challenge of playing the music is twofold. You know, the hard stuff that you have to play that's composed, and then, you know, to keep yourself and the audience interested in your improvisational stuff. So you need a vocabulary to be able to make that different on a nightly basis, and you need musicians that are going to be able to listen and build on the story that you're telling. And so to a degree, that kind of process is lost because less and less of a younger audience know anything about it.
Yeah, well, you're right. And it's so easy now, unfortunately, it's so easy to become a major star, you know, and you have visual aspects to it with all the video stuff and everything that's pumped through that way. And then you can, if you have a hit, you can sell it for 99 cents, I guess, in theory on, but as far as the real ability to get up and play. And by the way, when you do it with Zappa, plays Zappa, or the stuff that you've recorded on your own, or when Frank did it, if you did a 15 or 20 minute live, you know, kind of extended version of a tune, it was really more complicated than, I don't want to bash any particular bands, but back in the 70s, there were rock bands who would show up and do 20 minute jams, and it was garbage. You know what I mean? It was just, they were very successful. But when you show up, or when Frank showed up on stage, it was within that very tight structure and timing, and then the ability to kind of move out and then come back together. It's like an entropy thing where you're coming back to the, and it all makes sense, and it all ends at the time it's supposed to end. But right now,
I appreciate that you got into it and you enjoyed it. The what I was talking about before, you know, it really is that you just need people that are all in the moment together and listening. You know, that's the way the improvisational stuff works. You know, some of the other things that you described, you know, sound like there's some meandering going on, and maybe it's drug ladle, you know, drug riddled kind of influence
where people are not really
tuned in to the music. They're tuned into something else, you know. So,
which, you know, has a purpose, but not when I want to see somebody play like when I've seen Zappa play Zappa. What your tour? I don't know, two or three times, and I appreciate so much the effort that you're making. And it's almost like each year you have to do a. It's not like you can just show up and people shout out tunes and you can play them. You can if you have those things in your quiver, but you need to. It's almost like a symphony, a season at a symphony. You have to get ready to find a certain piece of Frank's music and get it to where you can get it on stage and make it that precise and with all that skill. You just don't show up and hey, let's do some stuff from this album. You gotta practice it.
The music is really, really difficult, and it is hard to choose what stuff we're going to feature each time. There's so much to choose from with the over 80 albums that he made, but we always endeavor to showcase things that are different for each tour. So, you know, we learn everything, classical stuff, jazz stuff, rock stuff, whatever is in the catalog. So the hardest stuff to really do is the major orchestral pieces, to arrange them for what is now a six-piece band is, you know, a very challenging thing, so that you get all the, you know, the harmony and all the parts that need to be played in there. So it does take a lot of effort.
And talk about that for a minute, Dweezil, because some of the compositions were orchestral, not just because he could play them that way on stage, but he actually wrote the charge for what would in essence be an orchestra.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, is that a lot of people don't know, but my dad started out wanting to be a composer, you know, when he was 10 or 11 years old, and he went to the library and he started reading about how to become a composer. And he taught himself everything he knew about music from going to the library. He was, you know, completely self-taught. He never went to a music college or any of that kind of stuff. And so when it came to writing the music that he wanted to write, he didn't have any boundaries. He wasn't constrained by certain things that are taught in music schools about how, you know, some things just don't go together. You know, that didn't apply to Frank. He would put anything with anything just to hear what it sounded like. You know, and if he liked it, then that was the music. You know, so that kind of fearless approach to combining different things is what made his music really stand out, particularly his classical stuff. The rhythms that are in his classical music are definitely way more sophisticated and complex than, you know, composers like Beethoven or Mozart or anything like that. So it's very modern stuff, but it's now reaching a new generation of people within that realm of music, not only the people that like to listen to it, but the people that are actually conducting it and talking about, you know, presenting modern composers for audiences of the future. You know, my dad's music is getting played more and more and being more sought after by different ensembles and orchestras across the world, but that wasn't always the case. When he made records of his classical music that he recorded, you know, he put up the budget for these things himself. Most of the time, composers have always been under some sort of a lottery system where, you know, if you go all the way back, it was like the king,
the patrons,
would finance stuff, right, you know, and then it just became about like government organizations or big donors that would support the arts, and somebody would get funded for for their music to be heard and played and recorded as far as modern composers go. But that was not the case with my dad. So I can remember him when he did the London Symphony Orchestra record in the early 80s. That record cost $500,000 to make.
Wow.
You're not going to make back a $500,000 on a classical record.
No.
You know, that was the kind of thing that was necessary for him to hear his music. He had to earn money and spend money just to hear his music be played by a world-class orchestra. And so, you know, that's that experience wasn't his favorite either, because the working with the orchestra, he was very frustrated because they wouldn't rehearse enough, and it cost so much to rehearse, and they were constantly taking tea breaks and all this kind of stuff that was all union, whatever. And the musicians were just basically mercenaries, you know. They're like, we won't do it unless we get paid more money for this, that, or the other. So it wasn't about, you know, hey, this is a great piece of music, I'm so excited to play this, you know. So there's some frustration there on that side of things when you're composing that kind of stuff, and then, you know, everybody says, no, it's not possible, or it's going to cost this, and, you know, how does it get done? You just bite the bullet, and you
did
it.
You do it.
But, you know, I think ultimately what I'm getting at is that he just loved music. He did it his own way, and that was really the whole journey for him was he had ideas in his head, and for other people to hear them, he had to put the notes on the page, and he could do that. He could sit on an airplane, and he could write a whole orchestral score for every instrument, just hearing it in his head, which is, you know, incredible that he could know the ranges of the instruments and hear all the harmony and all that stuff, and just put it on a page, you know. So that's how he was able to write so much music in a short period of time. Is he just had that ability?
That's amazing. And there were no constraints. I mean, he might do a tune that would be a minute and a half long, or it might be something that was, you know, 15, 20 minutes long. It's just whatever said, whatever he needed to say, this is just my words for it. When I listen to the music and the very complex stuff and some of the stuff that was just like a short spurt, I just think that's all he wanted to say at that particular moment.
Well, yeah, I mean, the inspiration for stuff can come from anywhere, and the form and structure of it can be whatever you want if you're the composer. But the main thing is that there's so much depth and variety from record to record. It's not a rehash of the same idea over and over. So, you know, his vocabulary of, you know, the harmonic content was very intense. And the rhythmic stuff that he did was really just so far ahead of its time in so many ways. And there's just so much complexity in some of the things. So by the time he got to using a computer system, that's when his music became virtually unplayable. You know, that's the stuff that he wanted to hear in his head. He knew that a lot of musicians would not be able to play some of these crazy rhythms that he was writing. So at the end of his career, he was using a thing called the synclavier, which was a computer-based software thing where you could write your own music and have it played by the computer. And so a lot of the stuff that he was writing there was incredibly dense. It's challenging to listen to as much as it is challenging to you know, imagine how to write it. But the thing about it is, for me, going back to people playing the music, I've always, you know, preferred to hear real people play stuff rather than a computer sequence. Mm-hmm. But the some of the stuff that he wrote, which he originally thought could not be played, ended up being played by different ensembles, and one piece in particular is a thing called G-Spot Tornado.
Mm-hmm.
And that song, I learned part of it on guitar at a much slower tempo than what it was when he released it on this record called Jazz from Hell, which it was played by the computer. But he had heard that I was playing parts of it, and they thought, well, maybe there are people that would take the time to learn this. And he ended up working with the Ensemble Modern out of Germany, and they ended up making a record, called The Yellow Shark. And there's a version of G-Spot Tornado on there that is unbelievable. That and Dog Meat, which is the Dog Breath Variations. Those two pieces in particular have so many amazing melodies and crazy rhythms, but they got massive standing ovations at the performances, and you can hear it on the recording. And so, you know, he ran that gamut of trying to write stuff that was in his head. Some of it got to the point where it was unplayable, and some he thought was unplayable, but with a little coaxing, he got some of that stuff.
Wow. Well, I mean, he covered so well. You've already said. Let me ask you this, because I remember, and I get a little fuzzy on the timing of these things, and I don't happen to believe that anyone invents out of whole cloth a form of music, but around the time when fusion jazz, which happened to fit me because I was kind of raised on rock and I discovered jazz on my own, and then all these great fusion guys came around. What do you think that Frank was like the underground version of what became more popular as fusion? If you think back to the late 60s, early 70s, some of that sound that he had. I mean, heck, he even had George Duke and Jean-Luc Ponty and all those guys who went on.
Yeah, I mean, I think all that style of music is, it really is just, you know, how to fit players that have a lot of depth and variety in their own, you know, vocabulary, how to fit them into a musical environment, you know. So that became the fusion thing. I don't think anybody ever sat down and said, hey, you know what would be great?
Right.
If there was a new thing called fusion, you know.
Right.
It's just it evolved over people having different interests and blending different styles. So I think my dad was just always doing that. And you know, there became sort of an offshoot form that became the fusion thing. And you know, these days there's the version of fusion that is out there. You know, I think it as in all musical forms, certain things become homogenized and become a version of a lowest common denominator thing. So there are all of those elements, you know, even in the world of jazz.
Sure.
So, you know, sometimes fusion is not a compliment.
Well, I understand what you're saying, but I struggle for the words to describe that,
yeah,
that change between the 60s. And I always thought it was like guys who were musicians who grew up playing and rock, and then they discover jazz, and like you're saying, you have to find a way to fit all those things into some sound that they can do, and then they drift back maybe into jazz or more traditional,
yeah,
forms of jazz. But I mean, it was perfect for me at the time, just from a selfish point of view, that I was looking to make that transition from what was boring me on the radio for people my age into jazz, and it was like, oh no, I can back up and find this stuff, and then I can go back and find out what these guys were listening to, and you do that little historical search for yourself to make yourself,
yeah,
a little more knowledgeable. Is great for me.
I think there's, you know, you could definitely trace elements of some of those kind of sounds that became whatever that world of fusion is,
well, yeah,
you know, to some of the stuff that Frank was doing. But he was just always on that journey anyway of just blending different styles and sounds together. But the problem, I think, that comes in defining music is that people want to put boundaries on things so they could better understand it or better explain it to somebody else. And when you have the boundaries, you know, sometimes music can't continue to grow, you know.
Right.
So I think that's when you end up with some sort of stagnant kind of things, and you end up with what would be, you know, the equivalent of like smooth jazz, smooth fusion,
yeah,
and all that kind of stuff. That's,
yeah,
like
awful. It's awful music. awful. On the show that I do on Wednesdays, where I'm going to air this every couple of months or so, I will. And it's amazing when people call me to complain. I give a no Kenny G guarantee, on for my show, and people will call in and say, "But these, but that's jazz." I said, "That really isn't." That, well, you have to play. No, I don't. I'll play Kenny Garrett. I'm not going to play Kenny G. And they get so defensive, you know, because he's playing something that in their mind he's got a saxophone, must be jazz. And you wind up running into those barriers where, you know, look, just because they use an instrument that might be identified with an art form doesn't mean that's what they're playing. Doesn't mean they don't sell a hell of a lot of records.
But I mean, the thing that, you know, when it comes to like somebody like Kenny G is that he's a good musician.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
He's a good
musician. No question.
But you know, the stigma that comes with it is that it's like it's a people-pleasing kind of version of musicianship. And so, you know, people tend to not listen to see if he is actually doing anything else other than what they consider to be, you know, kind of smooth elevator music or whatever the thing is. He may be doing other stuff, you know, or trying to do other stuff, but nobody's paying that much attention.
No, and he's an easy target. I don't mean to pick on him because there's lots of people like that. But no, he can play. It's just that he's found this very comfortable thing, and no one's going to see past that zone for him, no matter what he does. I think that's what you're saying. You're exactly right. Let me ask you this real quick. The tone, this very fat, almost palpable, it's almost like a physical entity of Frank's guitar, and you have it also. And I know that you know, and maybe you help rebuild guitars or have some interest in what goes into the components of a guitar, but Frank and you also have this incredibly fat, thick tone on the guitar, and it can't just be the mechanics of the instrument. There has to be something that you're feeling and looking for. And you know what I'm saying? That really, it's almost like another person on stage.
Well, the thing is, my dad was very knowledgeable about the science of sound in general, and so when he was making records and he was orchestrating the music so that it could create a good mix, you know, the timbre of instrumentation was something that was part of the composition. And so when it came to a guitar sound, he wanted a guitar to sound like it had some attitude. Mm-hmm. And usually, you know, most of the space that a guitar takes up in a mix is in the mid-range. And so when you have a mid-range boost with, like, you know, a wah-wah and things like that, you're going to hear the expression of the guitar a little bit more. But he didn't use a wah-wah the way most people would. He used it more as a tone-shaping thing. And so you have this kind of nasally sound that's in there that gives it this attitude, almost like you're turning your nose up at somebody anyway, you know. And he had said in some interviews where, you know, he wanted his guitar to sound like the stuff that, you know, he grew up listening to players like Clarence Gatemouth Brown, Johnny Guitar Watson, sure, Wes Montgomery, and so there was a lot of different things even in those players that I mentioned, but they had a particular attitude that came across, and he wanted his attitude, his guitar, to basically sound like, if you attributed it to a personal style, you know, it was that this guy is a bad person. You know, he wanted it to sound like it was, you know, this guy's mean, this guy's, you know. So it was, I think that the tone that he went for was a really ever-changing thing, but generally when it came to the rock or more rock sounds that he got, he focused on this mid-range that just put it so much in your face, you know, and it really is something that it takes a lot of experimentation to get the right combination of equipment to make the sound, you know, really work well.
Well, it's a great sound, and you do it. I mean, and I know it's such a struggle. I know that you work very hard to do what and travel with what is what you call Zappa Plays Zappa. And I know it's a constant, you know, all the music that he recorded. I assume there's stuff he'd never recorded that you have access to.
Oh yeah, there's tons of music that you know is in the vault that people haven't heard yet, and some stuff you know, I mean, of my dad's, you know, but there's some stuff that we have learned and played that had never been played live on stage. You know, it might have only been something that was, you know, done in the studio or, so there's so many things to choose from. There's just a ton, but in general, you know, I mean, the motivation to do it is just it's as a musician, there's really no other music that I've found that's more fun or more challenging than my dad's music because of the what we were talking about before, you know, the two kind of strict disciplines of one being the composed side of it and the other being that you have to have a good vocabulary in the improv side of it to really make that stuff be authentic and make it work, you know. So there's a lot of work that goes into all of it.
And he had such a precise wit, and I don't mean just in the songs that people would think of as comedy tunes. Within the music itself, there were witty parts that were clearly...
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
They were put in there to kind of shock you and also say, here's a little musical joke with no words, no spoken words or songs, but he was incredibly witty.
One tune that comes to mind like that would be Holiday in Berlin, full blown, you know, because first of all, the idea of a holiday in Berlin in the early 60s would have been just kind of a ridiculous thing. Anyway, but then when the music just starts going completely out of tune on purpose, it's just so funny. I mean, I listen to that and I laugh every time.
The other thing, and I want to take some time and talk about Zappa Plays Zappa, because I know you're on the road, or at least you're going to be very soon. If you're not, I know you're coming to the Cincinnati area, which is real close to me. But the other thing too about Frank, I don't believe, I've told you I'm a lawyer during the day, and I, you know, First Amendment, but nobody was a greater proponent of freedom of speech than a more eloquent speaker about that aspect of freedom of creativity than Frank Zappa.
No, I agree. You know, he was the first person to jump out and defend, you know, the music industry when the PMRC was trying to get that legislation passed to basically censor music and label records and all that kind of stuff. And he had one quote that was hilarious when he was speaking before the Senate, which was... they were treating the problem like treating dandruff by decapitation. that just always made me laugh. But essentially, you know, he wanted to be able to protect not only his own ability to write music the way that he wanted and write and sing about whatever he wanted, but, you know, in doing so, it was also something that was beneficial for everybody else. But, I mean, he could see the stupidity in the approach of all that stuff because, you know, it was easy for people to get concerned about, oh, this is going to ruin our children when, you know, bad parenting is what ruins children, not music.
Can you imagine the mindset of a congressional panel or committee, whatever, and you know, they're given some memos about this. A guy named Frank Zappa, he's a rock guy, and they're going in thinking they have preset thoughts about what this guy's going to sound like, and then like 2 minutes into it, they're like, "Holy moly, what are we supposed to do with this guy?"
Oh yeah, I mean he was always such a sharp you know, speaker. I mean, there's another great example of one time he was on a show. And he was in his late 20s when he was on this show, but there was this guy in the 60s called Joe Pyne.
Oh, God, yeah.
And so he had Frank on the show, and he had apparently had a war injury, which was, I guess, known about by his audience. But so he attacked Frank immediately when Frank came on. He said, "So I guess with your long hair, that makes you a lady." And Frank said, "Well, I guess with your wooden leg, that makes you a table."
Now that you say that, I remember that, and that's beautiful. That's perfect. That's one of those things you can almost, if you remember anything else about his contribution to that dialogue, That pretty much sums it up. If you could only do two sentences, that sums
it
up.
Well, the thing about it is that he had this innate ability to say what you wish you would have said had you thought about it, you know, like for 2 days. Mm-hmm. You get to write, come back.
That's right.
You just would say it in the moment.
That's right. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, well, let's talk then about Zappa Plays Zappa. What you're doing now, I know that you put a lot of effort into the presentation and the practice. And as I say, you're coming to Bogart's, I think, here July 12th in Cincinnati area. So
yeah.
Let's talk about that just a little bit. And you've been so nice to give me so much time, but let's just touch on that for a minute.
Sure. Zappa Plays Zappa is an ongoing tour. We just, every tour, we focus on different music that we want to be able to present to the audience, give them a chance to see it live on stage, either for the first time or, you know, a chance to hear it again. So there are things that we're looking at for this time around because a lot of the tour before we end up in Cincinnati is up in Canada, and we're playing several jazz festivals. So a lot of the stuff we're focusing on is going to be some stuff with some big brass arrangements. So there's going to be things like the Grand Wazoo, and we're probably going to do things like Big Swifty, an orchestral piece that we're working on called Sinister Footwear. So there's a lot of stuff that has pretty major orchestration, and that kind of stuff takes a lot of preparation to do it, but so in combination with all of that stuff, there's going to be, you know, some other stuff from early in Frank's career. So, you know, we kind of mix it up all the time. A lot of my favorite stuff is from the 70s, and you know, we play a lot of that stuff, rotating things in and out, and have done since 2006. So we're going to get some more stuff from the 60s, and then you know, maybe a little bit more jazz stuff here or there in the show. So it's definitely a different flavor than any other tour that we've done.
Well, and I know that you work very hard to go back and resample bits of stuff that maybe hasn't been played in a while, because it's not, you aren't just doing Zappa Plays Zappa is not just incredibly talented people doing a cover band. You are really resourcing all that great stuff and making it come back and practicing and getting it to get that feel. I mean, you can all do the music or you wouldn't be on stage with Dweezil. I can just tell the guys who are with you and the people and all the musicians.
Yeah. But, I mean, the thing about it is that the music is the star of the thing, you
right.
know? And it's, we just work as a sort of a repertory ensemble. We're trying to choose a selection of music each time we go out on tour that focuses on a different area of Frank's compositional style. And, you know, so it really never is, there's no such thing as a greatest hits review
no.
in this, because, you know, he didn't have that kind of career.
No.
So, you know, we definitely want to play songs that people will recognize, or, you know, some things that they come to expect, but we also like to surprise the audience with things that are very sort of deep tracks that they may be hearing for the first time, you know. So it's a challenge to create that right balance.
Well, you're doing it the right way, with all the respect and all the attention that you give to making it work. And you know, and for the people listening, Dweezil has a career as Dweezil Zappa. I mean, you are elevated, man. You're on covers of magazines for stuff that you did before you sort of retooled and went out with Zappa Plays Zappa. Dweezil Zappa is as fine a guitar player as there is, and the fact that you're willing to take on this task of this incredible volume of music and all this different variations and bring it to stage is a credit to you that you can do it and that you're willing to do it.
Well, I appreciate that. I mean, ultimately, you know, I'm a fan of the music, just like other people that have a chance to check it out. But there's an audience that's unfamiliar with it. So that's the reason
Sure.
that we wanted to create this opportunity for, you know, a younger audience to carry the music forward. And, you know, I have not had a chance to do that much with my own music for a while, but I have more recently been working on a lot of stuff so that I can do that. But my own music has changed so much since doing Zappa Plays Zappa, because I have so many more things that I can do, and I the whole process of composing the music is different for me.
Yeah.
So it'll be an interesting thing when I actually get to focus on that in the next year or so.
What a great side benefit, huh? You get to play all this great music, and then you incorporate it in, and you recognize different things that you can do as a composer and player also.
Yeah, it totally is a complete, a whole new world of stuff. So it's exciting. I've been working on a lot of different things as far as guitar technique goes. I had to do a lot to change what I used to play or the way I used to play in order to play the stuff on tour. But even that has evolved over a period of time now. So there's some new things that I've been working on for a while that are finally just starting to take root in my playing. So it should be interesting to see what I'm able to pull together over the next couple tours here, because I started doing a lot more stuff with extra fingers on my right hand as far as picking goes. So there's like a weird new hybrid picking style that I've created for myself that is allowing me to access different notes in different ways, and so it's going to really change what I do.
Sounds great. I mean, in the tour, like I said, I've seen it two or three times. I know that I'll see it again coming up soon, and boy, it's a great, I mean, if there's a Zappa fan or if just a live music fan and you want to be exposed to what Frank did and see what Dweezil's doing with it now on stage, The Zappa Plays Zappa is just a phenomenal evening.
Well, I appreciate it. Yeah, we're definitely looking forward to getting back out and playing.
All right, listen, Dweezil Zappa, thanks so much for dropping by and chatting. You've been very generous with your time. I know you're very busy getting back into preparation and whatnot, so this has been a blast for me. I appreciate it.
Sure, no problem. Thank you.
All right, thanks.